Welcome to Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast. I'm Jacques Friesen. My apologies for not recording anything last week. I work for an essential business, and we were going 10-10ths, getting all of our customers and those out in the field everything they needed to do their daily tasks, and then some. I hope all of you are doing well in this uncertain time. But with that said, I'm back for episode 6, and my guest today is one Jim Vassar Jr., or as you may know him, Jimmy Vassar. I hope this goes well. I hope you enjoy what we're doing here with Kentish. Spread the word. Enjoy it. I'm doing this more or less as just a record of those who have been in the sport of Formula Ford and those who've impacted it. And obviously, Jimmy was the 1986 Formula Ford champion and has gone on to not only be an IndyCar champion, but a successful team owner in the sport. So without further delay, Jimmy Vassar.
Welcome to Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast. With me today is the 1986 SECA Formula Ford National Champion, Jimmy Vassar, who also won some sort of championship 10 years later in IndyCar racing. I don't know, something about that. Jimmy, welcome to Kentish.
Hey, pleasure to be on, bud.
Yeah, absolutely. So you are born and raised Southern Californian, which seemed to be the hotbed, if there ever was one, for Formula Ford activity. Where do you call home nowadays?
Actually born in Southern California, and then we migrated to Northern California. And that's where I kind of grew up, went to high school, and I was a member of the SF region at SCCA, but we did, and which was a hotbed as well, and we did venture down to Southern California, and Formula Fords were just the it class before so many junior Formula classes that are out there today. So that's how I kind of got my start in open wheel, and then currently I split time between Las Vegas, which is my primary residence, and Napa Valley, where I have a couple automobile dealerships and a small winery.
Very cool, very cool. So in that start into racing, I assume you went straight into Formula Ford, or did you have like karting experience before that?
No, I was a quarter midget guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was about six, we went quarter midget racing very seriously. My father, like most young guys that are racing or karting or quarter midgets, it takes a family, and it's a whole family, you know, mom and sisters. And my father was really a maniac about it. We traveled the country, and, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, traversing across the country and racing for the Grand Nationals. And that's how I got my start.
Awesome. Yeah, my chief mechanic restores vintage quarter midgets from the 50s, so very cool.
Oh, those are very cool. Man,
yeah.
I wish I had one of my old quarter midgets.
Yeah, so...
There's one of my old cars that, in our quarter midget club, young Jeff Gordon kind of was in our club, and there's a car that we both won races in. It was an old Wahlberg rigid car.
Yeah.
So I always thought, man, I got to get that car back, because when I was done with it, John Bickford got it from my dad, and Jeff Gordon actually won Grand National in it as well. So
wow,
it'd be a great historic quarter midget to have.
Wow, absolutely. That's really cool. So I know you have a certain Swift DB1 in your collection, but if we go back to the year before you made that car famous, in 85 at the runoffs, you qualified 5th and finished 25th in a 43-car field. The results that year show that you were a lap behind at the end. What happened in your first runoffs appearance?
It might have been the last lap. I don't know if I didn't finish, or I think it might have been the last lap. I was trying to get by a guy named Jackson Young. I was just buried. I think it was for 4th. I might have been running 4th, going to 3rd, and he just had me off. At the dip. This is before the chicane. It was just the dip, and then you went to the bridge, and I think that's why I didn't really finish. But we should have done a lot better. I was competitive, and I think you had beaten Scott Atchison, who won the race, in one of the final races before we went out to the runoffs, and we just didn't do well. I wasn't prepared. It was my first time. I think we just didn't have our stuff together. Well, I mean, we were top 5, but not.
Yeah.
Not to win the race, and so that's kind of what happened, and then we, you know, we buckled down and actually didn't do the car ourselves. We gave it to the Viper Ridge Racing, Bob Lesnett, his operation, and they ran the car for me. My dad kind of backed away. They ran the car for us, and it was just a different story. It was kind of a perfect weekend for us. But that's the same chassis that I have. It's chassis 33 of all the DB1s built. I think it was a 1983 model.
So in 86, you won the runoffs, leading 16 of 18 laps and finishing nearly 5 seconds clear of the pole sitter Richard Wakefield. The field was stacked that day. If you were to look at it, somebody my age, I'm 35, but if you look at the rundown of drivers that were in the FF field that day, you had Dean Hall, who made a few appearances at Indy, Robbie Groff, Dave Wietzenhoff, who won everything in Formula Ford, and one Tommy Byrne. How much do you think it affected not only your career, but your confidence in moving up to the upper ranks of junior formula car racing, winning that day?
It was everything at the time. I mean, Formula Ford was a strong class, and it was really the most important thing for me at the time. It gave me a little bit of notoriety. I got closer to Swift. So then in 87, we were meant to run one of the first DB4 Atlantic cars, and Atlantic was a pretty strong class at the time. Mm-hmm. But it just came out so late that I really missed most of the season, and we didn't come out. Our first race, I think it was Portland. We had a small problem, but we won the race at Laguna Seca in front of the Indy cars, and yeah, it was the Formula Ford win at Road Atlanta helped me just get kind of closer to the factory. While it didn't all go roses from there, mm-hmm. You know, there was a setback one year. We didn't have any budget. Everybody knows that story.
Yeah.
And I raced a series called Corvette Challenge. It was just a bunch of stock Corvettes. And that was kind of, we had a podium or something, but it was just not the way I needed to be going.
Yeah.
And then all I was able to drum up after that, but through my Swift connections, we were able to jump into Formula Ford 2000 in Canada, and what was called the Export A Formula Ford 2000 series.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
And
So if we go back, the 86 runoffs win, would you say that was your greatest win in FF, or were there other wins you had, especially back in your home tracks, that you felt more accomplishment with?
That was one of my greatest wins. And then there was a series called the NORAM Pro Formula Ford series.
Mm-hmm.
And I won a couple of those, and they were always in front of the big crowd, you know, the Indy cars or the IMSA Camel GT series. Those were always great, but certainly winning at the runoffs.
Yeah.
And I won an award called the President's Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a big award at the SCCA Awards. So that was hands down my biggest Formula Ford win. My first win was actually in my first car, which was a Crosley 32F.
Yeah.
And those were some good times too. There were some really big fields in the SF region, and so there was a lot of great memories there too.
Yeah. What did you enjoy? You know, obviously Formula Ford, it's the beginning for most people. What did you enjoy most about your time in Formula Ford?
Just the machine. It's such a great machine, right? Mm-hmm. And learning how to not scrub speed and carry speed through a corner and out. And it was always great competition. I still have a lot of great friends that I met in those times. I mean, a lot of times you look back and your best memories in motorsport or racing are, for me, or those times, or even quarter midgets, in meeting people and keeping friendship for a long time. And I just recently actually made friends with somebody that you know, Rod Bolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Who's got a team up at Elkhart Lake with a fleet of vintage cars, and it's just a great community of people and racers, and I'm hoping to compete with him. I think in June or July, at the big historic race, to drive one of his cars at Elkhart Lake this year.
Oh, wonderful! Well, if that event does happen, you'll be on track with me and my Eagle. So that'll be awesome. If we fast forward to 1990, what was it like to be the very first American chosen by Jeremy Shaw and the Team USA scholarship?
Well, it really wasn't. I didn't know what to think at the time. mm-hmm. because it was new, and it certainly wasn't what it is today with a big shootout. And Jeremy's done a fantastic job cultivating that program. And if you just look at the names of the champions that he's turned out of his program. It's really a phenomenal achievement, and all credit to Jeremy. He's worked tirelessly putting together a group of backers and sponsors, none of us knew what it was going to become then. Mm-hmm. But it was a cool experience. However, I was in a car that was a good car, but it was a one off. It was called a Lannan, mm-hmm. And it was built by an engineer named John Bright, who a lot of people might know from the IndyCar paddock, and he's a very talented guy. And I remember going over, actually Jeff Gordon was supposed to be in that car, mm-hmm. and for some reason he couldn't do it, and Jeremy called, and I thought I was a little too old for it, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. I had just won an Atlantic race, I think. I won the East-West shootout at Elkhart Lake, so I felt like I was a little farther up the rungs, but it's mostly really young drivers, and I remember going and on my airplane I had a fresh JIV engine that he sponsored for the race, and they picked me up, and we put this IV Kent engine in the trunk of like a Mercur or whatever, a Ford, whatever they called them over there.
Yeah.
it was fun times. It was a little bit slim pickings, but The car was okay, but it really wasn't. And I was out my first heat. Mm-hmm. I was out at Druid. I came together with a couple of German kids, and so it was over. It was pretty short lived.
In 2020 or 2021, when we get a full season, do you think that there is room in the American market for like a Junior Formula Festival to help spotlight younger talent?
I just think there's so many classes now, right?
It's mm-hmm.
Back in the day, Formula Ford was where everybody went, because there really wasn't the road to Indy and all these other classes to showcase yourself. So, listen, if anything's promoted, if you get a full field of talented young drivers, mm-hmm. and if you get the right people behind it, it'll fly. I would welcome and love to see the Formula Ford class gain some traction and momentum again, because it really is a great training ground, and you really have to be talented to run up front of a competitive field.
Yeah, absolutely. With that said, you've raced Indy cars, Daytona prototypes, Atlantics. You had a bout in stock cars. Where does Formula Ford rank? Just in the enjoyableness of turning a wheel and stepping the go pedal.
It's so cool, you know. I mean, just remembering I was 18 years old, and you know, looking down at that tag, and I got my race car, and it's just something I'll never forget. And you know, when you get up to the top classes, there's a lot more to it. In the periphery,
mm-hmm.
Sponsors and business and Formula Ford. It was just me in the car and my dad and maybe a couple of helpers, and you know, you just had to win. You know, you can have the approach too where it's just fun and mm-hmm. it is a blast. It's just a great machine to drive.
Mm-hmm.
So pure. However, you know, when you got somebody like my dad, you know, looking at the stopwatch and either smiling or shaking his head, you know, it can be kind of nerve-wracking for a youngster.
yeah, no doubt. As the man who won the 1996 kart championship, you had some Formula Ford legends surrounding you in the form of Mike Hull and Chip Ganassi. Do you think Formula Ford was the sort of breeding ground for that sort of mentality needed to develop a high-functioning racing organization such as Chip had back in the day when you ran?
Yeah, and he still has it. Mike mm-hmm. Hull is still there.
Yeah.
And absolutely. It goes back to what I said. Back then, Formula Ford was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you wanted to be anybody, you know, in Southern California, you had to beat Dennis Firestone. Or you know, I had to deal with Bob Lobenberg.
Mm-hmm.
East Coast, you had Wiesenhoff, and and so and you know some guys and you know it was it. And then if you were, then hopefully you could make it to then Super V or Formula Atlantic. But that was it. And anybody who was anybody back then came through Formula Ford that really was in the 80s. I mean, Bill Fickling, I drove for Bill Fickling. He's another legend. And then Bruns and all that group down there. It was the top of the heap.
Yeah. Yeah. So this past week, another mutual friend of ours, the guys and gals at Styled Aesthetic, came up with a super rad line of shirts helping benefit the Red Cross. And they showcased a certain red, white, and blue 91 Lola Chevy that you raced for the Hey Ho Cole team in 92.
That's right.
Obviously, that's pretty rad. And I know their goal is to reach, I think, was it 1,000 shirts?
No, they're pretty modest. They're modest goals, but it was a... And I can't take credit any credit for other than saying, yeah, let's do it, and dug up a couple of old photographs.
Yeah.
You got to hand it to Steve and Heidi Welch. They do a great job. They do the apparel for both of our IndyCar team, Vassar Sullivan IndyCar team with Santino Ferrucci Steelmaster car,
mm-hmm.
and our Lexus IMSA effort. They do all the apparel there. So just great people. It was a great idea. And helping the blood drive, the IndyCars involved with Roll Your Sleeves Up, and it's been a pleasant surprise to see the reaction. And I didn't pick the car; they kind of came up with it as a rookie car and a throwback.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a pretty bitchin' idea, really, you know. And that was an interesting livery. It was kind of short lived as my rookie year, but it kind of disappeared by Indy,
mm-hmm.
where I subsequently broke my leg in the race. It was a cold 92 race. But
yeah.
The Stars and Stripes was the Dennis Conner America Cup boat racing team.
Okay.
And yep. that was the connection there. It was kind of a cool platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know the Steve and Heidi. Steve and I were college roommates for one fateful semester, and he also I ran for a short while spec Miatas, and Steve drove our other spare car. So good people.
Very, very cool.
So did you think after winning the runoffs in 86 that it would take you 6 years to get on the kart grid?
Yeah, I didn't really have a master plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually the funny part is my first car, my Crosley 32, was painted just like the Pennzoil PC9 that Rick Mears
nice.
Was driving for Penske.
Yeah.
And I was at that point, that was 1984, and at my first race, that was at Sears Point, and you know it was a regional, but there was 40 cars on the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And first race of the year in March, and I'd just come out of my SDCA driving school. I had a license, and I had a big N on the side for novice, and I stuck it on the pole. And I thought for sure, this is how naive I was, I thought for sure that Roger Penske had already heard this, and I would soon be getting a call, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, to answer your question, maybe it took a little longer than I thought to
yeah.
call my way to the grid.
And was IndyCar racing your ultimate goal, or did you have aspirations for F1 or anything that way?
I thought no, it was IndyCar because in quarter midgets, all my buddies went to sprint cars and midgets.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I thought, I like going to do Indy. I want to do road racing, and going to midgets and sprint cars wasn't the way anymore.
Yeah.
This was in the early mid to late '80s, or really mid '80s. Me and my dad and I went to watch a Camel GT race in 1983 at Laguna Seca. And we ended up trading a 911T, a 71 911T for the Crosley, to a guy named Pete Weldy who had won the race that day.
Hmm.
We just kind of wandered over there to bullshit with him, and he's like, "Oh, mine's for sale." And we're like, "Oh, really? Yeah, okay." And then, so we bought the car and rebuilt it over the winter, traded him the 911. I wish I still had the 911 too. I think it's probably worth $100,000 now. But
yeah.
But that's kind of how it all. How it all got going, but just a great class, the best car, you know,
mm-hmm.
the best car to start, you know, and then if you can't afford that, then the Formula V,
mm-hmm.
which is also a great class.
Yeah, absolutely. Here in Wisconsin, it's kind of a hotbed for some of the top V guys, and I know some people look down at the smaller formula stuff, and I don't get it, because you know people are racing, other people who are racing, yeah, who are other people are racing, and at the end of the day, the first place prize you get for Formula V, everywhere I checked, is the same one you get for GT1. So you know.
Well, listen, in the Formula V races, at least when I was going to the SCCA, I mean, people would line the fences to watch a V race.
Mm-hmm.
The drafting, just great, great races. You know, Steve Knapp, you know, that's where Steve Knapp came out of, so.
Yep.
And I won in 86, I think he won the V race, and I won the Formula Ford race.
Yeah, and another Formula V racer who now runs FF is Scott Rubinzer, who, his shop is about 3 miles from ours. He was a damn fine Formula V driver, and he actually won the Formula Ford runoffs back in, I think it was 2011. So, very quick driver. Okay. So,
yeah, very similar. You know, V is a similar class to Formula Ford, really. It shouldn't be separated that much. V was very, 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 very difficult, great racing, good competition.
Mm-hmm. So, if we look at the car you first ran in kart in 92, the 91 Lola, and the one you ran in 2006 for PKV, the Lola B03, how astronomically different did things feel behind the wheel from that first car to the last?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. You know, mm-hmm. you're dealing with the components that you have at hand, and to answer the question, not much,
mm-hmm.
not much.
Yeah,
you're trying to get the most out of whatever you're behind the wheel of. And so there's a lot more similarities than there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's transitioning from braking, downshifting, turning in, and, you know, carrying speed, get on the power.
Yeah.
And then your job's done.
Yeah.
So then you take your rest on the straightaways or you set up, and then you prepare for the next transition, whether it be, you know, a 90 or a hairpin or a, you know, an S or a series of corners that you have to be here and be there and then be here, you know. So that's the biggest part in my mind,
mm-hmm.
of driving, whether it's a, you know, two different Lolas or an Atlantic or, you know, or a Formula Ford.
Yeah.
It's the breaking down, the transition, get it all done, get it done in a short period of time, get off the brakes, roll your speed, carry your best speed through the middle without compromising the exit, and then you deal with the tools and the control. Like, you know, the difference was it was an H pattern, right,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a sequential. So there takes some different skill sets there, but you do whatever it takes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right, so we'll get off the history of Jimmy, and we'll move on to I just call this category other. So, if you could pick one dream boat race car to own and have an unlimited allowance to maintain and run around the world, what would that one car be?
I don't know if there would be one car. If I had that much of unlimited, you know, I'd be like Zach Brown, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
He's got Formula One cars. You know, I like the 917. Is that the open cockpit car?
Yeah, the one from 72. Yep.
Yeah. You know, I think that would be something. Just the sound, 917. Maybe there's some V12 Ferrari. Maybe the 512 Ferrari might be a cool car.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are not open wheel cars either, are they?
So, no.
You know. These are sports cars, so.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that the open, I like the open cockpit, or maybe a McLaren, what was the orange ones? Is M3 or M2, 3?
Yeah, that one. Yeah, that variety. Yeah.
That era.
Yeah.
I like those cars. Yeah.
Awesome.
It wouldn't necessarily be a Formula One car or anything like that.
Sure. Sure. No, I get it. So,
I have an Indy car too. I could take that out.
Oh, do you?
Ones aren't unlimited. I've got the last Lola I drove before I retired full time.
Okay.
It's a B03, the one you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
With a Cosworth in it. That's ready to go. I got to freshen it up a little bit, but I often thought that maybe I'll go historic racing. I can bring the Ford or the Atlantic. I got my Swift DB4 as well that I drove and won championship, or won, I didn't win the championship, won eight championship races, and that Lola I do have. So okay. I'm prepared to go historic racing. It's just a matter of time and some more enthusiasm.
Yeah, well, you'll find out if you pull out the Swift, there is no shortage of the Swift falls into the, it's called the post-Club Ford category, but usually at any vintage race around the country, you have a minimum of 25 Fords running. So it's, you that's, always have yeah, somebody to awesome. Race with.
That's awesome, yeah. I'm looking forward, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah.
Hopefully this year.
Awesome. So out of the thousands of drivers you've seen in your time, whether they're schmucks who shouldn't have gotten near a car or the finest of the finest, there's probably a few that stick out in your mind as being maybe underappreciated or perhaps lost in time to the fact that they didn't make it professionally. If there was somebody that you could spotlight and go, he or she was amazing. And, you know, I always call this like the grandfather question. You know, back in my day, there was this one guy you'll never read about, but he was legit. Who would that be in your book?
There was a guy named Tommy Neils. It was a great carter, and he won some Pro Sports 2000 races, and that's about as far as he got.
Mm-hmm.
And he deserved to do better than he did. Tom Neils from Southern California, KNEILDS.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty badass. But I don't want to leave anybody out. You know, the thing is, there were so many drivers that had what it took to kind of make it, but either one, they didn't get the opportunity, or they got the shot, got the opportunity, and for whatever reason, it didn't go well, right? Whether they fucked it up, excuse my language, or got taken out, or had a mechanical.
Yeah,
it just, you know, when you're shooting for the stars and you get an opportunity as a young driver. And you get that opportunity that's so important. It's almost imperative that you have to win, and usually you win going away, or you know, you have to do something spectacular, and then you got to kind of do it consistently in the lower formula to get the shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a young man who beat you for the 1991 Atlantic Championship, who got a shot.
Yeah, Joby Marcello.
Yeah, he got a shot to be a rookie at Indy the same year you did. And unfortunately passed away. How, for those who, I know I have a very interesting audience that follows Kentish. For those who maybe don't know his name, how good was Joby Marcello?
He was real good. Yeah, he was real good, man. We had a lot of battles, and you know, he got his shot, and unfortunately, you know, he passed away in practice. I don't know what happened. It was kind of an outlap. And somehow he lost the car, or maybe something broke. And what happened is, and this was something, you know, you learn the hard way, or the series learns the hard way. His headrest behind the helmet flew off at first impact, and then his helmet kind of split up, and he hit his back of his top of his neck there, kind of basal area, hit on the tub. So then they were developed more. Head surround and more and better, and not just Velcroed on.
Right, right. Yeah,
Joby was a very good driver that, you know, that was living a dream. Right, he got a shot, and I think he's the only driver from the Philippines to ever make it that far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true still today. So okay, so you still own your DB1 to switch pages. Any plans that you're going to get it out of hiding anytime soon?
Oh, the DB1. Oh, it's ready to go. Actually, I had it freshened up years ago. I don't have any real plans, but I brought it up and talked about it a little bit just more recently with Rod Bullhouse and just kind of shooting shit. And you know, there's nothing been set in stone to bring it out, but we have brought it up and tossed it around a little bit.
Awesome.
I think if I come out and do that race, This year, it'll be in one of Rod's cars.
Yeah, they have a very nice fleet. Awesome. Well, Jimmy, I can't thank you enough for your time and energy in joining me today on Kentish. For those who might be intrigued by your life, where can they find you on social media?
I just said, at Jimmy Vassar. I think it's a underscore on Instagram and maybe the same on Twitter. It's just at Jimmy Vassar. I'm not huge at social media. I'm not on Facebook.
Yeah.
Also my race teams, we have the VS IndyCar, with Santino Brucci's our driver, and AVS. AVS Autosport on the IMSA side, and that should give people a little taste of what's going on in my life.
Awesome. Well, Jimmy, thanks again.
I should put a plug in.
Yeah.
Actually, I should put a plug in for V12 Vineyards. V12 Vineyards in Napa. We're a wine enthusiast out there. We have a website, and we have a very boutique small winery. But give us a taste.
Awesome. Well done. Well played there. Well, Jimmy, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks again, and best of luck for this year. Hopefully things kick in sooner than later.
Yeah, likewise, Jock, and I really appreciate the interest in having me on today, bud.
They say in life, don't meet your heroes. I think Jimmy Vassar smashed that saying and probably punted it in the next county. He surpassed everything I thought he'd be, and what an engaging character for being somebody who's reached the pinnacle of the sport of auto racing to come on this podcast, because literally we are fresh out of the box, and he doesn't know me from Adam, but it was wonderful of him to share his memories and time in the sport, and just a very down-to-earth guy. So I'd like to thank him for coming on today, and obviously I want to thank everyone for staying tuned for episode 6 here. We'll be back next week with a guest who's not yet planned, because who plans for anything right now? And anyways, I hope you're all well. Hope you're all doing good. Keep your wits about you. If you need somebody to chat with, you know how to find me. Be well. Cheers.